everybody, this is Matt Frazier, author of the new book, No Meat Athlete, Run on Plants and Discover Your Fittest, Fastest, Happiest Self. And it is a pleasure to be here today with my co-author of the book, Matt Rusigno, who is a registered dietitian and is also a vegan, and also happens to be a pretty good ultra-endurance athlete. So Matt, thank you for taking the time to do this and help people understand nutrition a little bit better.
Hey, it's my pleasure. It's what I do. It's been an honor to be a part of all of this.
Yeah, it's been fun, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
Good. So, what we're going to do, I'm actually midway through the book tour as I'm recording this. I'm about, I guess, 2 weeks into it. And what I've noticed is that just about every event in the Q&A section after my talk, somebody asks, what do you eat in a typical day? And people have even told me that they love the book, but they had, you know, kept expecting this part to be in there, like, you know, the list about what I eat in a typical day. But my answer is always that the book wasn't really about me. Like, it's not about what I do. It's about what, you know, what is kind of that we're recommending you do and that we're, you know, just trying to inform here, making it about the community, not about, like, you know, what we in particular do. But that said, I thought that would be a really great jumping off point for this call. We can kind of just start. Matt and I will go through and let you know, like, what it is that we actually do eat, like, what's a very typical day. Both just a normal day and then also when we are in the midst of training for something. And then from there, we'll get into just kind of some various topics. Again, many of them just have come about because people have asked them frequently in the Q&A sessions. But others are just some special topics that we did not cover in the book in any depth because of space issues, but that I think a lot of people are curious about. Does that sound good, Matt?
Sounds great. Can't wait.
All right. So, Matt, why don't you go first, just because I've been talking for 5 minutes already, and let us know, like, you know, what is your typical day, and then we'll get into training stuff later on, but just right now, what does a typical food routine look like for you in the day?
So I had this breakfast that I got from a raw food friend of mine that's so simple and easy and surprisingly tasty. Even my college students, when I taught college in South Central Los Angeles, I told them my breakfast and everyone scoffed, and then a few students tried it and said they loved it. And it's really simple. I take, you know, two or three or maybe four if I'm training, ripe bananas, and I mash them in a bowl. And then I add a couple tablespoons of nut butter. I like almond butter, peanut butter, sunflower seed butter is delicious. Mm-hmm. And then either diced apple and blueberries. And that's it. And it's, you know, mostly raw depending on the nut butter. And it's filling, it's healthy, it tastes great, it's easy, it's cheap. It's all the things I look for in a good, healthy meal.
Okay, and what part are you mashing up? All of it or just...
No, I just mash the bananas, and then I put the peanut butter or whatever on top of that, and then the diced apple I throw on top of that, and it kind of gets mixed around as I eat it. I've joked and called it a non-blended smoothie.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. But it's what my kind of go-to breakfast is. And honestly, I recommend oatmeal a lot, but I'm not a big fan of oatmeal. To me, it's camping food. It's the only time. You only eat it when you have to.
I've never liked oatmeal either.
And then I'm fortunate in that my schedule varies a lot. So I like to do a workout in the morning, not first thing, but like mid-morning after I've done a little bit of work and after I've had time for my food to settle. And then for lunch, you know, I like it really easy. I do a stir fry, you know, broccoli and zucchini and kale are almost always in there. And then I'll add some tofu maybe or other sort of, you know, veg protein. And then eat that over some noodles, you know, maybe a real basic sauce, just sriracha and soy sauce, you know, and then sometimes maybe a peanut sauce.
Okay, and what kind of noodles? People are going to want to know that, I'm sure.
Good question. Sometimes the sticky rice noodles that you make pad thai with, but those are actually very, very low in protein. So I'll use whole wheat spaghetti noodles, even if I'm making like a Asian-style stir-fry, just to get the benefits of the whole grain, get some of that protein and iron that's in, you know, 100% wheat, whole wheat noodle.
Right, good. That's actually one of the things I've been saying in my talk is using as an example that protein is in everything, not just meat and dairy, as most people listening to this call will, of course, know. But like whole grain pasta, which, you know, I always did think of as a carbohydrate food, like you carbo-load with pasta, you know, has like... I don't know. When I last checked the box, it was like 13% of its calories from protein, which is really right, pretty close to where you want to be for your general diet. So, you know,
exactly. I use that example in one of my presentations where I'm saying, like, look, you haven't even added a so-called protein food yet,
right,
and you're
right.
already at, like, between 12 and 15% of your calories from protein. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Even tomato sauce has some protein in there.
Right. Okay. So that's lunch.
And then for dinner, and then I graze a lot. I love to snack. I love just, you know, eating apples throughout the day. I'll eat a little bit of nuts. I try not to overdo it because they are so calorically dense. And then for dinner, you know, the joke is I love to eat burritos. So I eat burritos pretty often just because, you can mix it up. You know, I'll roast sweet potatoes and then cook some black beans and, add a little bit of sauteed kale. So I have a sweet potato, black bean, kale burrito, maybe with some avocado and some hot sauce in there.
Okay, good. So that's your typical day then, right?
Yeah, I think so. And then, you know, if I'm training a lot or if it's especially hot, I'll do a smoothie, you know, and I use frozen bananas as well as unfrozen bananas, I guess you would say, in order to get like a nice cool liquid to bring my core temperature down, you know, and also get all that nutrition too.
Right. Gotcha. All right. And then for your burrito wrap, again, because people will want to know, are you using just like a regular whole wheat type wrap?
Yeah, I do the 100% whole wheat, and I'll do corn tortillas sometimes. Sometimes I'll make little tacos and use the corn. You know, I have an organic corn tortilla that I really like, and the secret to that is to heat it up first. I know some people don't realize that.
Yeah, that's right. And you were the first one, I think, to teach me that you could do it right on the gas burner.
Yep.
You have like a gas flame, and that works really well.
It's amazing how it changes the texture. It's yeah. Totally different food.
Yeah, and you do have to heat them up. I mean, if you don't, they're just not very good. I mean,
right.
Even if you don't have gas, just put it in a pan and get it warm, and it's good. So I'll get into mine in a second. But something that has jumped out already is that you know, it sounds like you and I have talked about wheat before and gluten and things like that, and I know where you stand on it, but I'm curious to hear, and people will wonder, I'm sure, when you mention having wheat in two different meals in the day, what is your stance on it? Because I know you try to generally not eat it all the time, but go ahead and let people know, like, what is your stance on wheat?
You know, most people can eat it without problem. That's absolutely true. You know, from just a strictly nutrition standpoint. But a kind of bigger picture thing is we are eating as a society too much wheat, and we should eat a larger variety of foods. I think that's true. And a lot of the criticism on wheat is about, you know, refined wheat products, you know, which is much different than 100% whole wheat, which I think is a healthy part of a meal, you know. But with that said, you know, I do vary it. I try to eat other grains, you know, I eat quinoa and brown rice and those sorts of foods as well.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I stand too. I've done, I think it was Brendan Brazier who I heard talk, and he actually recommended doing like a 10-day test without wheat, like a totally gluten-free diet, and just basically see how you feel, and also pay attention to how, when you reintroduce it, how your body reacts. So I did something like this and didn't notice anything at all, like not the first difference. So I concluded from that my body didn't have a problem with wheat. But we should make it clear, I mean, that many people do actually have a sensitivity, if not full-on celiac or I guess a gluten allergy, which I think are different things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, for most people, my view is if your body doesn't have a problem with it, and I think it is worth just experimenting to determine if it does, because you may not even notice that you do have a problem because you've never tried it without. But yeah, I mean, once you determine that you don't have much of a sensitivity, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And again, you know, we are talking about whole wheat products versus refined wheat, because there's not much disagreement that refined wheat is not a very good food at all.
Right. And you know, I use sweet potatoes and butternut squash as an alternative to grains all the time. Like, I'll make a stir fry and eat it over roasted sweet peppers.
Mm-hmm.
Or sweet potatoes. Yeah,
sure.
You know, it serves a function as a grain, and when you look at it from a macronutrient standpoint with carbohydrates and whatnot, it's pretty similar.
Right. All right, so while we're on the topic of wheat, before I get into my daily diet, this is somewhere I wanted to go later, but what about seitan as a protein source? I know a lot of people do like it, and some say it's not as processed as, you know, some other foods are, certainly not as processed usually as the processed soy products, tofu, tempeh not included in that processed group. They're very minimally processed. What do you think about seitan? It is, because it is a big protein source if you want it to be.
Right, it's very condensed, you know, protein. It's the protein that's taken out of wheat, absolutely. But unfortunately, and I'll start by saying I do eat it, but unfortunately, the digestibility of gluten as a protein is very, very low, you know, lower than other vegetable sources of protein. So that's something to take into consideration, that you don't want to be entirely dependent on gluten for your protein sources.
Okay, got it. But if you're going out with friends and it's in the burrito that you're eating, it's pretty good then.
Yeah, it's tasty. Why not? Absolutely.
But yeah, okay. So yeah. I think that's a good thing. It's not a poison to your system. I mean, for most people, but you know, it's probably not the best protein source, because the grams that, you know, they're not really adding up to the amount of grams that it seems, just because the digestibility, absorbability is not so good.
Right.
Cool. All right. And I guess while we're there, let's talk about the soy thing, because I tend to think of seitan as like the other sort of whole food fake meat, even though it's not whole food, but the other, I compare seitan and tempeh. I just think of them as like sort of counterparts. One is soy, one is wheat gluten. So let's just go to the soy. I mean, what is your take on soy? I know that I share it with you, which is why I'm calling it ours, but mm-hmm. Can you explain that to everybody?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the fear-mongering amongst soy is just so ridiculous. You know, there's a little coffee shop in my neighborhood that has tons of vegan options, a bunch of non-dairy milk options, but they refuse to carry soy because they say it's unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of this anti-soy stuff really goes back to the Weston Price Foundation that, you know, is adamantly against vegetarianism, and they've just attacked soy. And people read only headlines and hear other people talking about it, and they just repeat these phrases that are just absolutely untrue.
Right.
But soy is healthy. There's no reason not to eat it. You know, you don't want to have 10 servings a day, because you don't want to have 10 servings a day of anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we mentioned this in the book, but for those who haven't seen it, check out Leo's article at Zen Habits. It's zenhabits.net/soy. And he was the first one who I saw who, you know, had actually done a whole bunch of research and really did trace all this stuff back to Weston A. Price. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that it all does come from one place, and yet there's this whole, like, you know, mindset in the U.S. and I'm sure other countries that soy is terrible for you.
Yeah, and, you know, it's kind of the reality of dialogue, you know, in today's world. You know, if you ever follow, like, Food Inc., for example, on Facebook, you know, the discussions there, you would think that soy was like killing and maiming children, you know? And no one wants to hear the truth, because it makes their lives easier to be like, no, that's evil, therefore all these other things are not true about vegetarianism or something, you know?
Right, right. And I guess we should make the distinction here that the soy that both of us eat and recommend is the minimally processed varieties, which for me means tofu and tempeh for the most part. I'm not sure about soy milk. I don't believe soy milk is particularly processed, but the things like the textured vegetable protein and the soy protein powders, those are what I tend to stay away from, just because I don't want any processed food, soy or not, and they seem to be, you know, have a high degree of processing.
Right.
Good. All right. So, after those long digressions, I will finish the answer to our first question, was what we eat in a typical day. And mine's going to sound a lot like yours. The smoothie is what I always start with. It's what I've come to, actually started to learn this as I've been traveling so much, is that most of the time, most days before about noon, I'm eating completely raw. And it's not really on purpose. It's just that, as it turns out, there aren't that many cooked vegan foods that are also, you know, that I also consider health foods that work for breakfast, or that I want for breakfast. So, you know, most people are eating eggs for breakfast all the time who aren't vegan, of course. And that's out. Then you've got, if you're talking about cooked food, you've got bagels. And every once in a while I'll have a bagel, but for the most part, not. I like a sprouted grain English muffin sometimes, and I'll put some almond butter on there. Like the, I think it's Ezekiel brand, or their Food for Life. I forget the exact brand name of their English muffins. But for the most part, it's raw until 11 o'clock or noon. So I'll do the smoothie. And then, oh, and by the way, in the smoothie, I usually start it with let's see, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, flax seeds, and walnuts. So just like a tablespoon or two of each as the base of the smoothie, and then some fruit, always some greens. Like I like baby kale a lot, spinach too. So berries, bananas, very typical smoothie, and there's that perfect smoothie formula in the book, and also on the blog if you haven't seen either of those yet. And then, like, I'll snack usually in the morning on a raw trail mix type thing with just raw nuts and some raisins. Like I said, sometimes I'll eat the English muffin. And lunchtime for me is almost always leftovers from the previous night. I've done away with the microwave, not really sure for what reason, but I just kind of feel better about that than I otherwise did. I don't know. And I think the food ends up tasting better. So, you know, I'll just reheat leftovers in a pan or steam them or using some sort of method to reheat them. And I'll get to dinner in a minute because that, of course, is always what lunch is, too. But then almost always do, like, a big salad in the afternoon, which, again, is a pretty high raw meal. I will usually put some beans on there or some sunflower seeds or some sesame seeds. What I've always done from the very beginning of being vegetarian is to include some little source of protein in every single meal. And based on what we said, I mean, everything has some amount of protein in it. But what I mean is, you know, something that is as considered, that I consider a good protein source. So, you know, it could be nuts or seeds or beans or tofu on a salad. It could be almond butter or hummus on some sort of an English muffin type thing. It could be beans in a pasta sauce. I mean, just don't want to go into, like, the full carbo meal rut, which you know, people who are kind of the junk food variety vegans do, I think, fall into a little bit. And so that's my afternoon thing. I'll eat fruit and stuff throughout the day, and then dinner / lunch, which are, you know, of course, are two different meals, but one day's dinner is always the next day's leftovers. I do a lot of beans and rice type things. It often takes a different form, like lentils and rice, or something with like a wild rice. Could be an Indian dish, like a chana masala, which is chickpeas over brown rice for the most part, with a bunch of curry and spices. Lots of Thai dishes occasionally with tofu, just stir fries. And I mentioned pasta dishes. I'll do that a lot, very often with beans in the sauce, or some other, you know, getting some leafy greens into the sauce. Just trying to avoid the straight up pasta with marinara sauce. So I mean, I think they're very typical meals. They're not all raw by any means. I mean, the morning stuff is, but the lunch and dinner, I have never had any success trying to eat those raw. Me and my family, it seems, you know, we just crave the hot cooked meal at night. And I do believe that if we really wanted to, we could get away from it. But I tend to think that just incorporating a lot of raw foods into your diet has, you know, perhaps the same exact benefits as 100% raw. I realize, of course, that some people will disagree with that, but you know, for my lifestyle, it works, and that's really what my, you know, our book is about. It's about the lifestyle, you know, doing veganism, especially for athletes, in a way that is approachable. Like, I think Brendan Brazier's book Thrive is such a, you know, super healthy version of a vegan diet for athletes. But it's one that, you know, it's hard to do that if you have like a 3-year-old kid in the house, because he's not very often going to want the raw tacos with the collard leaf as the shell. So like, it just sort of, I don't know, for families, we wanted to kind of make something that was very, very approachable. Not to take anything away from Brendan's book. I think it's fantastic. It was the first one I ever read, you know, that was serious about plant-based nutrition. And he is a wealth of information, for sure.
But you're right. And there are a lot of different paths someone can go down, even within plant-based, you know?
Yeah.
And it's important to recognize that. And I think that people want to do exactly what you do, exactly what I do, when really this is just a jumping off point for them to find what exactly works for them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, and I, you know, fully hope that some people will do this and then start gravitating. You just find other blogs, other sites as a result, and, you know, go 100% raw if that's their thing. And I expect that will happen, and that's fantastic. I think people will do, like, we included oil in the recipes in the book, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but not in huge amounts, because we, you know, we recognize that too much oil is a bad thing. But at the same time, we think for athletes, it's not a bad thing in small amounts, and perhaps a good thing in some situations. But, you know, I fully expect a lot of people, because of the popularity of Dr. Esselstyn, Dr. Campbell's work that was, you know, made so popular from Forks Over Knives, that many people will eventually go the oil-free route, which is totally cool. And that's, I'm not against people going that route. It's just that that's not what I do, and I think it's slightly less intimidating to say, I'm going to go vegan, but I'm going to still eat some of these foods, versus I'm going to go vegan and also cut all the oil and all the caffeine and all the alcohol. You know, I don't want to be too mm-hmm. extreme in my recommendations, just because that's not the way that I've ever, you know, that didn't resonate with me from the beginning. So, you know, had to keep it real. All right, so those are typical days. I think people can probably, you know, see the similarities in what we're doing. They're very similar, based as much as possible on whole foods. As I said, neither of us is totally anti-oil, but for the most part, it's whole foods, and it's, you know, we each have a decent amount of raw foods, lots and lots of vegetables. Variety is such a huge key for both of us, and you know, that's your reason for avoiding wheat is the same as mine. It's just, you don't want the same food all the time, and it's not that wheat is so bad, it's just that we don't want any food for three meals a day. So, you know, wheat is one that in this culture happens to show up all the time in people's meals. But I'm not against it, and obviously neither are you.
Right, and I like that you touched on kind of eating Thai food and Indian food. You know, I'm fortunate here in Southern California, we have a grocery store called Fresh and Easy, and they sell these Indian simmer sauces. And it's just a jar of Indian sauce, you know, in different varieties too, you know, because that, you know, Indian food is so diverse. And, you know, all I do is saute some vegetables and pour the sauce over it and knead it over brown rice. And you have a meal that is as good as a restaurant meal, and you can make it so quick, you know?
Right, sure. Yeah, and that was one of the very cool things to me about going vegetarian, is that it just opened up my eyes and my palate to all these foods that I had just ignored. Like, I thought, you can't really cook Indian food at home or Thai food at home. So, like, I ate them the once a year that I went out to those restaurants. But as I started to, you know, not be able to go to, I don't know, Outback for dinner or Burger King for dinner, so I would start to check out the Indian restaurant, check out the Thai place, because they did have options for me. And then I liked it so much and realized that it wasn't that different from the food I was cooking, and started, you know, realize you can cook that stuff at home too. Sauces like that certainly help, and not everyone has a whole Indian spice rack. So yeah, certainly things like that can be helpful. So how about training? Let's say, you know, how does your diet, Matt, change during periods of heavy training, or even not totally heavy training? And I should have given an intro to you, by the way, and I'll probably go back and re-record one. But for anyone listening, Matt has done a lot of ultra distance stuff. The Furnace Creek 508 is the one that impresses me the most. I think, Matt, you've done it three times now, is that right?
Yeah, I've done it three times solo and then two times on a team.
Okay. And finishing the top 10 1 year, which is amazing.
Thank you.
And one or two iron distance tries, is that right?
I've done three, yeah.
Three, okay. Cool. So, serious stuff here. So, you know, when Matt talks about periods of heavy training, he's putting in a lot of miles, a lot of hours on the bike. And so tell us, Matt, how does your diet change when it does get heavy? And actually, what are you eating too while you're actually in the middle of, like, when you're sitting on the bike, what are you putting in your body?
You know, I find that I made a lot of mistakes, even as somebody with a nutrition background, when I first got into cycling and running. And that's a part of it, is, you know, I'm going to tell everyone what I eat and what works for me, but this has come after making a lot of mistakes that I think helped, because you learn what works for someone else may not work for you. And so when I'm training a lot, what is really crucial is, especially for endurance events, is just fueling while you're working out. You know, making sure that if you're doing a, you know, 3, 4, 5 hour bike ride, that you're staying fueled the whole time, because that way you can work out harder. So you get more benefits from the training that you're doing, and then you're not ravagingly starving when you get home.
Right.
You know, and what I find is when I'm doing a lot of volume and I'm building towards something, I'm really hungry. And I'm eating all of the time. And honestly, I'm eating more larger portion sizes of those same foods I mentioned earlier, and then just snacking more often as well. And while I'm on the bike, you know, I start with bananas and dates. I mean, those are kind of the go-to vegan fuels. I mean, not even vegan fuels. Lots of people are eating those while they're riding.
Yeah.
And And then I'll supplement that as needed with things like, I like Lara bars a lot. You know, they have minimal ingredients. And they're good for those longer rides when you're spending a lot of time on the bike, and they're calorically dense because they're, you know, they're nut based, so they're a little higher in fat, but that's okay at that point.
Right. Yeah, and for me, it's very much the same. I do dates as much as possible, and I think we mentioned this in the book, dates, but just to clarify for those who may have skimmed that part or skipped it, the dates that I tend to prefer are if you get like the medjool dates from the bulk section of Whole Foods or the health food store, and sometimes they're in like package bags and stuff, but they're the ones that have the pits in them. They're not the pre-pitted ones, because just generally if you get the ones that are already pitted, they're just not quite as soft and not as sweet. And, you know, maybe nutritionally they're the same, but I always actually really just look forward to eating dates that just taste, like, delicious to me. And that's only been since I actually started getting them with the pits in them. But they're great. Mike Arnstein, known as the Fruitarian, who has won several hundreds, including Vermont, placed pretty highly in Leadville. I believe he ate entirely nothing but dates and water during his Vermont 100. And I actually tried to do that for a short period of time and, like, did not want to ever look at another date again after the first, like, I don't know, 4 hours of doing that. So that's not something I can personally recommend, but it does work if you can do it. Because really, sugar is, for the most part, what you are after when you are doing an event. I mean, yes, there are certainly a place for, you know, more of, like, the more substantial real food during an ultra, especially more than a marathon, because a shorter distance, like a marathon, listen to this, shorter distance marathons. I mean, a marathon where the intensity is higher, you generally do want to stay away from things that aren't sugars, because the sugar is what's going to help you in that relatively short time period get into your bloodstream very quickly, and you don't want to have too much fiber and stuff for obvious, you know, digestive reasons. But for ultras, especially at the level that's, like, you're not trying to win the race, and perhaps for some people who are trying to win the race, having real food, you know, just helps you kind of feel more comfortable in your head. And for someone like me, that's important for not quitting. Because if one more thing feels bad, and, like, because I'm starving for something good and I'm only allowing myself to eat sugar, then, you know, that's going to make me want to quit running the race. So, I eat my share of, like, pitas with almond butter or hummus on them. Mm-hmm. Potatoes dipped in salt. I mean, that kind of stuff is all great. Not something I always usually train with, just because it's not so convenient as carrying dates with you. But at a race or any situation where I can, like, swing back to my house on a long training run, I will eat those kind of foods too.
Yeah, and it's so crucial to do race simulation, you know, yeah, so that you're out there for a long time and you see how you feel. You know, I got involved with that Furnace Creek 508 race because a friend was racing and I was his crew chief, because you have a support crew for a race that's 500 miles, you know. And what I did is I looked through, you know, the Adventure Corps does a great job of keeping track of previous years, and I found most people didn't finish because of stomach issues. And probably because they weren't used to eating for, you know, 24 hours straight, you know, or eating through the night. And people really try to do that race on, like, Oreo cookies and turkey sandwiches, right, you know?
Right.
And so what I did is I worked with my friend Morgan to really figure out what he could eat and not eat when he was under a lot of stress. You know, 8 hours into a ride, 10 hours into a ride, what does he crave or not crave? And it kind of took that just personalization in order to feed him then for, you know, it took him 41 hours to finish that race,
right,
you know, but he had no stomach issues, you
right
know, and I think we need to do that even for something like a marathon or a half marathon. You know, how do you feel 10 miles in at hard effort? What could you eat or not eat? You need to know that before the race.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, what I tend to recommend to people, like, who are running, say, a first marathon, is that they use the first few long runs, like the first three quarters of the training program, to really experiment with all different types of fueling options, because you're not going to know what does and doesn't work for you until you try it. And, you know, even if you found something that kind of works, you're doing yourself a disservice if you're not occasionally testing something else to see how it goes. There are certain situations when that's better than others. And one, you know, an obvious example is the last quarter of a training program, I think, is the time to really start doing, like, dress rehearsals, basically, of the race itself, and eat exactly what you're going to plan, what you're eating during the marathon. So, like, for your 20 miler, you know, do exactly your exact same nutrition strategy as closely as you can, so that you've done it and you've seen how it works, and you can make tiny tweaks as necessary those last few weeks. But, you know, I say experiment in the beginning and then sort of refine as you get closer.
Yeah, great advice.
All right, so, and the last thing to touch on is just, you kind of mentioned this, Matt, but you said you tend to eat more calories just throughout the day as you, you know, just more snacking, larger portions. Is that something for you that is deliberate, or are you doing it just sort of naturally? Like, for me, that happens very naturally. I'm just hungrier because I'm putting in more miles, so I will eat more. But some people are much more careful about calories and, you know, much more numbers-oriented than I am when it comes to nutrition for sports. Are you doing that on purpose, or are you just kind of eating when you're hungry?
You know, a bit of both, honestly. I know what has to be purposeful for me is eating after the workout. And I can't stress that enough for everyone, is you need to put those calories back into your body as soon as possible after your workout. And, you know, not only does it help you recover faster, but you'll feel better the rest of the day.
Right. Sure. Absolutely. And in the book, there are guidelines for, you know, specifically how to do that. Like what nutrients you want in immediately after, and then an hour or two later, what should you be focusing on? So we certainly don't need to go into that here, because anyone listening to this call will, in theory, have the book, unless they snuck on here somehow. Okay, so we've got about another, I don't know, half hour or so. So let's go ahead and hit some of the topics that, you know, just there'll be quicker answers, I think, and quicker topics, but the ones that we didn't touch on too much in the book. The first one, very common question I get, is do you take any supplements? And my answer is almost none. I don't even use protein powder anymore. I was using protein powder in my smoothies, and from time to time I still do. I'm not against it, but I just tend to use a hemp protein powder. I'm not overly concerned with getting the complete amino acid profile that you'll get from something like pea, rice, and hemp blended into a protein powder. Especially because it's a little bit harder to get the pea and the rice proteins in as whole form as the hemp seems to be, or as minimally processed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's kind of complicated, but from reading some stuff from Dr. Joel Fuhrman, I've become somewhat less convinced that we, you know, really need to pay that much attention to the essential amino acid profile. Certainly don't need them in every single meal, as Matt, you write about in the book. But, you know, that's kind of a little bit maybe more than we need to go. But anyway, protein powder, I'm not against it. I just have tended to get away from it. It's kind of cheaper for me not to do it, and I don't notice any real difference when I don't put it in my smoothie in the morning. So, you know, having the nuts and seeds in there does give me that protein. So I don't do protein powder anymore. I don't do any other supplements for the most part. Every once in a while, I like fool around with creatine, and I know some people think that is unhealthy long term, and I'm kind of wondering the same thing. I'm really on the fence about it. I've seen some interesting stuff about, you may have heard this, Matt, because we worked in that article together, but that, you know, it was only one study, but basically showed that vegetarians who take a creatine supplement actually do perform better on, like, intelligence tests. And I've heard it suggested that perhaps that's because, you know, vegetarians are in a state of relative creatine deficiency compared to everyone else, just since it's in so few plant products. So even though it's not something that, like, you're going to necessarily notice if you don't have, there may be some you know, brain benefit and other benefits to having it. It also does put on some added weight, which makes it less than ideal for endurance sports, where you absolutely do not want extra weight, because I think it holds water is what I've always heard. I don't really know about the science behind that. So I have fooled around with creatine in the past, you know, 2 years on and off, but not really sure where I stand on it. I absolutely do not think that anyone needs to take creatine, even an athlete. And the only thing that I do take is multivitamin, and I've gotten away very seriously from the megadose multivitamins. I don't want that, and I don't even want any vitamin that I'm already, you know, getting a lot of in my diet. So I'm a big fan of Dr. Fuhrman, and I actually get his multivitamin that is designed for someone who's eating a diet like he recommends. So it has a few of the things that are very important, B12 being the big crucial one, as you taught me, Matt, or as you, you know, have kind of convinced me, I should say. B12 is not available in any plant foods unless it's there because the food was fortified or in supplement form. So, you know, while it may exist in some algae and different things like that, there seems to be some sort of mechanism that blocks absorption of it. And I know people will argue with this, but that is your stance, right, Matt? That is not, you know, B12 is not going to be available in anything
besides right, exactly, exactly. It's not in seaweed. It's not in tempeh. It's not in kombucha. Mm-hmm. And it's so unfortunate that these myths are just are out there and, right, and being pushed. I mean, people argue with me about it all the time, and I point them to the studies that say these are just analogs, meaning it will show up saying it's B12, but it's not the B12 that we need. And, you know, Jack Norris at veganhealth.org is very, very clear about this. He shows all of the studies. So anyone who doubts this, I send over there to look at veganhealth.org and see the actual studies. You know, we need to take a B12 supplement or get it from our fortified foods. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right, right. And to be clear, like nutritional yeast, people will say, well, that has B12, but that's because it's fortified with it.
Right. Some nutritional yeasts.
Some, right. Not all, of course.
Yeah.
Anyway, I actually have Dr. Furman's vitamin with me right now because I have it in the car. But, like, there were a few things in some of his books that he believes that vegans are a little bit low on, or potentially low on. Iodine is one of them. I believe zinc and vitamin D. So, you know, these are included in the supplement. They're not huge mega doses. They're relatively low percents. And, like, I think that's important. I don't even know that I want to keep taking a multivitamin. I kind of want to think more closely about, you know, am I already getting these things and perhaps don't need them? But the B12 is one that you are always going to need as a vegan, unless you are eating, like, you know, consistently the fortified foods and the same ones, and you can, you know, reliably get a decent amount each day. And there's all kinds of stuff around B12, like, you know, that you can either take a very small amount each day, like 2.5 micrograms, or take it once a week, but then you need, like, I don't know, what is it, 1,000 micrograms? Something much, much bigger than 7 times 2.5. So there's lots of weird stuff, but yeah, Jack Norris, great place for lots of info about that. So check that out, veganhealth.org, and that will go much more in-depth than we are. But one more thing we should mention about B12 is that there are two forms. There's the, I believe it's, let's see, the methylcobalamin, am I right there?
Yeah, methylcobalamin.
Yeah, methylcobalamin.
Cyanocobalamin.
And then cyanocobalamin, I think. If I'm saying one of those wrong, I apologize. But cyano and methyl are what I remember. There are lots of arguments I've seen online. Like different authorities will recommend different ones and say that, you know, it's more absorbable than the other form. So I'm not convinced. It seems that the methylcobalamin is the one that is in the supplements that are made by the people who I tend to like Dr. Furman and some others, but I've heard it both ways, so I'm not convinced that one is necessarily clearly better than the other. Matt, any opinion on that? Like, is one?
No, I mean it doesn't matter that much.
Okay,
that's what I say, and for people who think it does, the research is out there for them to read.
Okay, all right. So how about for you, Matt? Supplements? Do you take any besides a B12?
No, I take a B12, and I use flaxseed oil, which is, I use it as if it was a supplement. I'm only taking it for the omega-3 fatty acids. I do use whole flax seeds in my smoothies. I grind them in a coffee grinder first and then add them to the smoothie, or I'll grind them and just add them to salads as well. But for the times I don't do that, I do add a little bit of flax oil to make sure I am getting some of those omega-3s every day. So that's, even though it is a food, I am kind of using it as a supplement.
Gotcha. Okay. No multivitamin, though?
No, I don't take one.
Okay. I've heard Brendan Brazier say he does not take one either. And, you know, after that is when I started to doubt the importance of a mega-dose multivitamin. And now I'm very much against those, so...
Yeah, the only, well, not the only, there are reasons to take multivitamins, and I think some people whose diets could use the aid should take them. You know, if you're unsure, take half of one a day, always with food. But one group is premenopausal women, you know, need to take, I think, not always, but need to be very aware of iron.
Okay, good.
You know, and that's true, vegan or not, really.
Right, right. And Matt has an excellent post on No Meat Athlete that is, I think it's called Iron for Vegans, Are You Getting Enough? Or something like that. But if you just Google No Meat Athlete Iron, you will find Matt's post about it, which has a lot of really good information. Of course, a lot of that information is also in the book, so you may not even need that. All right, so let's talk about some of these more hot topics recently. Again, I had the idea for these from the Q&A, so I suspect that people will be interested in these. Matt, juicing. It's gotten really popular because primarily because of Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, which is a cool story about a guy who loses a ton of weight. Not literally, but a lot of weight. I mean, I guess no one has a ton of weight to lose, but I haven't seen it myself, but hundreds of pounds, I believe. And so it's gotten really popular as a weight loss tool. My personal thing is I prefer whole foods over foods that are not whole. And when you juice, you are removing the fiber, the pulp, so that, then you have a concentrated amount of sugar that we're not really built to take in that much sugar at once. You can take in, you can eat easily 8 apples worth of juice without a problem, but you could never sit there and eat 8 apples. Well, you could, but it would be weird. You wouldn't. So, I just always prefer to drink smoothies because they are whole food form. And even smoothies are criticized sometimes for that reason, like the fact that when you blend foods up, it is easier to take in larger amounts of them because I guess the volume goes down somewhat because it's in this liquid form and it can sit in your stomach and not hit those same stretch and density receptors, and your stomach does not feel as full, or that you can take in so much right away before you even have a chance to feel full. Whereas eating food that you have to chew is slower, and you will get the signal that you're full ahead of time. As an athlete, that's not a big concern to me, but I just wanted to let people know that is a criticism of smoothies. But I think juicing is kind of a more extreme example of that. So while I drink juice now and then, like just because it tastes good and it's just fun and I don't know. And I think maybe if you're fooling around with the juice cleanses or like trying to get into raw food, then it's kind of fun and exciting to just try a bunch of juices and realize you are getting, these whole bunch of nutrients at once and that your body's not doing a ton of digestive work for it. I mean, I think that's kind of fun to do, but I don't think it's something that's really good in the long term for health. What do you think, Matt, about juice?
Yeah, I go back and forth about this as well. What I've found is that I like it. Like, I like drinking juice. Not that I ever buy it, but I like the taste of homemade juice. It was one of my very thought out, purchases to buy a nice juicer. And I do it a lot in the summer, when it's just harder to stay hydrated when you're training a lot.
Right.
And some apple, apple carrot ginger juice just tastes really good.
Right, sure.
And you are losing some of the nutrients because a lot of the nutrients in fruits and vegetables is right underneath the outer layer, and that's exactly what's being taken off when you juice. So you are losing those nutrients, but on the other hand, like you said, you're eating like or drinking, 8 apples worth. And so that adds up pretty quickly, what's left.
Right.
Then I also do it sometimes if I'm trying to cut weight, I'll do it. I'll juice as like meal replacement,
Yeah, and I think actually the two things that you mentioned, one, training a lot, like if you're making a sports drink out of juice, or using it to replace carbohydrates immediately after a workout, or using it as a pre-workout thing to kind of carbo load, or the day before a race to really top off the glycogen levels. Those to me are great uses of juice as an athlete, and I think they're much better than doing the same with, say Gatorade. And then you mentioned cutting weight. I mean, the fact that people are losing weight and tremendous amounts of weight after they see Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead and go on some sort of juice cleanse, I think that's a good thing. Like if you can use juice in a way that causes you to lose weight, and in a way that is healthy, of course. And I'm not going to go in, of course, to like what we're counting as healthy and what isn't, but use your judgment and consult someone who really knows what they're doing. But yeah, if people are losing hundreds of pounds from juicing, then I'm not going to say that's a bad thing at all, because I don't think maybe once you do cut all that weight and you're down to a normal weight, I think in the long term it's probably best to, not take in quite so many calories from juice. But I think it's a great thing if it's helping people lose weight.
Right, and for most, quote, normal people, who want to lose weight, one thing I do is I cut, drinking any calories. And again, this doesn't apply to athletes usually, but a lot of people drink things like store-bought orange juice and apple juice, thinking that they are healthy foods, and in a lot of ways, they're not. Right. And there are a lot of calories, you know. You can drink 200 calories worth of orange juice pretty quickly. And for most people, it's more than 10% of the calories they need for an entire day.
Right, right. That's a good point. And yeah, and the stuff that you get in the store, by and large, is not going to be nearly what, you know, the nutrients in there are not going to be what they are when it's fresh out of the ground and you squeeze it. So, you know, don't start drinking juices at all your meals when you're out because you saw fat sick and nearly dead. I think that's a fairly obvious statement, but just in case. So anyway, I guess the verdict on juicing is it's not something that I, you know, you want to be doing all the time if you don't have weight to lose. And even if you do have weight to lose, you need to do it correctly because, as you said, Matt, it is a lot of calories, so you can't just add juice to your meals and expect that to be some great thing for you because you'll be adding a lot of calories. And it may have some uses, you know, it does have some uses for athletes who want to take in sugar in a more concentrated form than they can get it from Whole Foods. And juice is a great alternative, I think, to most of the sports drinks out there. All right, so on a similar topic, raw food. People ask very often, have I tried a raw diet? And I have never actually fooled around or tested a week or 2 weeks of totally raw. I mentioned some of this at the beginning of our call. But I do think there are lots of great benefits to raw foods. Raw nuts especially, because of the omega-3s that, you know, many of which are destroyed in cooking or roasting. So I think raw nuts are great, and as much as I don't like them as much as roasted nuts, I've just kind of over time gotten used to having a raw trail mix without added salt, and I tend to like it now. So raw nuts are good. Raw salads obviously are amazingly good. Raw leafy greens are so good for you. Raw fruits, vegetables, I mean, you know, yes, get them. I don't think there's anything terribly wrong with cooking. I don't think cooking is like breaking your food and causing you lots of problems. But serious raw foodists, some of which are athletes who I respect, you know, say otherwise. They say that they do notice a huge difference when they go back to eating cooked foods after eating raw for a while. Of course, when you switch any kind of diets, you're going to notice a difference, but I don't know. That's how I feel. I think raw foods are fantastic. I don't think it's necessary to exclusively eat raw foods, but I think most people could stand to eat a lot more of them than they do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've learned a lot from my raw friends, you know, and just that you can eat two or three apples at a time as a snack, you know.
Yeah.
You can make a raw dinner and be satisfied. And there's a lot of benefits to eating fruits and vegetables, and eating them raw can be great. And so I've learned a lot, and I've incorporated it into my diet. I just don't see a nutrition necessity to eat entirely raw foods.
Right. Okay, good. I think we can leave it at that. I mean, there are plenty of arguments to be had about that, and if you search for them on the internet, you will find them.
definitely will.
That's honestly the extent to which I've thought about it. I have not really ever given serious consideration to doing it. But it would be an interesting test. Like, I think it is good to test things, and that's something that I haven't yet tried. So I think it's good to test and be fair about how it does feel. Also about how it works with your lifestyle and having kids and having to prepare meals for them. So I don't know, but that may be my future one day, a little raw test of some kind. But it's so hard for me to imagine getting rid of that hot meal when you come home at night, like especially when it's cold out. Of course, Matt, you in San Diego don't need to worry about situations like that, but most of us do, and I don't know, maybe you get used to it, but I just think it would be tough.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so oil we do talk about in the book. Matt, can you kind of sum up your view of oil, just, you know, as a registered dietitian? We see the forks over knives crowd, you know, being highly anti-oil, saying it destroys endothelial cells and is too many calories, it's not a whole food. These are the arguments against it. But if you look at who is eating oil, you know, Brendan Brazier and Scott Jurek are two of the big ultra athletes who I've looked up to who eat vegan diets. I'm not sure what Rich Roll does about oil. Oddly enough, as much as I've talked to Rich recently and read his stuff, I can't seem to remember from his recipe book if he has a lot of oil in there or not. So it seems that athletes are using it. Mike Arnstein, fruitarian, is not, because he does all raw. So I don't know. I, you know, the evidence from people who are, you know, there racing, winning races who do rely on oil. I mean, I think Scott Jurek is sponsored by Udo's, and he doesn't do a lot of sponsorships. Like, he really is selective about that stuff. Udo's is an oil company, for those who don't know. They make a 369 blend of oil that I used to take a lot, recently have gotten away from. But so Matt, what you know, sum up what your thinking is about oil, because I tend to agree with it.
You know, if we look at the general population, right, like my background is also in public health, you know, people are using too much oil. They're using too much added fat. That is true for the general population. But then when you look at it on an individual basis, it can be part of a healthy diet. And even though, you know, olive oil is not a whole foods, I wouldn't pretend that it is, what makes olive oil good is the monounsaturated fat that is in the oil. It's part of the fat of the olive, and it's what you're getting when you use olive oil. And the evidence that that's good for you is very clear. And so I think it can be part of a healthy diet without any problems. With that said, it's really easy to overuse oil because it's concentrated calories. You know, what is it, 110 calories per tablespoon? That can add up really quickly. And we need to be careful with how much of it we use, but we can use it. I mean, just sauteing kale and a little bit of olive oil improves the taste, in my opinion.
Right. I think you're right about that. I've tried some of the water sauteing stuff, and it works. I mean, it cooks the food, but it's just not as enjoyable, and I don't know, I feel like with this diet, they're, you know, like, less so now, but when I started out, I was thinking, if I'm not going to be eating meat, and I'm not going to be eating cheese, and I'm not going to eat all this other stuff, then I'm not going to deprive myself in other situations. So, to some small extent, I still feel like that. Like, I still don't mind adding a little bit extra oil to something because I do eat so healthily the rest of the time. That being said, though, since I have started to think more about oil and, you know, I guess move towards the forks over knives, no oil community, not in any way intending to get there, but like cutting the amount of oil that I take in half, just because I think I was one of those people who would, you know, put 4 tablespoons of olive oil in the pan before I started cooking, just because I thought, oh, it's so good for me, and, you know, I can have as much of this as I wanted. If you are using a lot, it's very, very easy to reduce the amount of oil you eat by like half. Like, it's, if you just use less in the pan, you almost don't notice. I mean, it's that easy. You can, I don't know, and nut-based salad dressings, if you like that, they're very easy to make in a food processor. Just look up some recipes, and that's more of a, that way you're still getting the fat in your salad dressing for some of the texture and the fillingness, but it's in a form that you know, many people do think is better than oil because nuts are a whole food. Mm-hmm. You've still got to watch the calories, like you said, because once you're processing the, or I shouldn't say processing, but once you're grinding the nuts up in a dressing, it then becomes really easy to take in a lot of it and more than you could, you know, it just straight nuts. So,
right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you had some good tips, Matt, like heat the pan up first and then add your oil to it so that it spreads out over the pan. You can see how much is actually in there. And that you don't need to put a whole tablespoon because often a teaspoon will do.
Right. You don't want to, you know, taste the oil per se. You just want to have enough for it to do its job.
Right. Okay.
You know, and you know, bringing up salads, like, that is a situation for sure. Like, I agree with, you know, Jeff Novick about the insane amount of oil people put on salads and still call it healthy. I mean, Veggie Grill, you know, the vegan fast food place that started in California here, I mean, their kale salad has something outrageous, like 60 grams of fat, because it's marinated in rice oil.
Right.
You know, right. And people don't know that. Oh, I'm going to get the salad instead of the fried big chicken thing. It's healthier, but they're eating more calories. It's hard for us to wrap our minds around that.
Yeah. Yeah, and at the same time, you know, on the other side of that, I would say if the only way you're going to eat that salad is by using a teaspoon of oil on it, you know, oil and vinegar, and, like, you just don't like any nut-based dressings, or you don't want to go to the effort of that, and you don't like the leaves of lettuce plain, then it's worth eating the salad and having a teaspoon of oil on there. Like, if that's how it has to be, salad's such a great meal. But, yeah, something extreme like that, 60 grams is ridiculous for a salad, and... that does bring up another point, like, which oils do you actually choose? I've heard more and more recently that olive oil does lose a lot of benefits as it's cooked and heated, especially to higher temperatures. So I tend to use olive oil as, you know, a lot of times as my unheated oil. So just to pour on a salad in some small amount, occasional other uses, and I'll use something like grapeseed oil for higher temperature cooking, just because it does seem to withstand the heat better, at least according to, you know, the smoke points and whatever they'll say. Not that I'm like noticing any breakdown of the oil as I'm eating. It seems to be just fine to me. But yeah, I mean, different oils for different purposes. We talk about coconut oil a little bit in the book. It's a saturated fat, and one that, you know, probably is easy to overdo it with. It for a while got the reputation of being this like superfood, and I think people were taking in way too much coconut oil and saturated fat. Brendan Brazier, you know, says that it is a, I believe, medium chain triglyceride, and for that reason is acts like a carbohydrate as a workout fuel, so he uses it for that. I'm not sure quite where I stand on that. I don't know. I guess that's sort of somewhat more complex than I tend to get with food.
Exactly, and that's what the research, that's the word to describe the research. It's complex. Mm-hmm. And what you're getting is a lot of people's opinions. You know, what I wrote about coconut and coconut oil in the book is my opinion based on reading the research, but you could ask 9 other dietitians and get 9 different answers.
Sure. And people have different needs, right? Like someone like Brendan Brazier, you know, he may find that it benefits him in performance, and, you know, maybe that's a personal thing, or maybe it does that for everybody, but for a pro athlete, that's probably a much more important decision than for someone who is much more recreational, like the way I am.
Right. Right.
All
right.
Good. So, besides that, I mean, I think that's almost it. The very last thing I wanted to hit on really quickly was macronutrient ratios. Talking about carbs, protein, fat ratios. What percentage of your diet should be each as an athlete? And really, the reason I wanted to include this here, we talked about it in the book, but I think it's so great that Chris Carmichael's book, I think it's called Food for Fitness, Eat Right to Train Right. I read it long before I was vegetarian, and it's, you know, it's what's great is that what he recommends as far as ratios, I think he says 13% protein, 65% carbohydrate, and then the remainder fat, and that would be, what, 22% or something. And it varies in different, like, he's into the periodization, as the year goes on, you change your ratio somewhat, but that's about the range that I suit for. And, you know, it's so great that the protein is that low for someone writing a book. This was 10 or 15 years ago now, but writing a book for endurance athletes that, you know, wasn't even thinking about vegetarian or vegan athletes. It was just kind of, here's what's best for endurance athletes. So it works very well with a plant-based diet. And what was I going to say, Matt? You have clients who are athletes and vegans, and I remember you cited once the range that you tried, that you tell them to get in terms of protein. What was that range? You may not even remember exactly, but about what are you telling people to try to get for protein?
You know, I would say between 12% and 15%, or even broader, between 10% and 20% of calories from protein.
Okay.
You know, and then the carbohydrate thing, if you want to start talking about that, you know, it's so interesting because I consider my diet to be high carbohydrate, but then every once in a while, you know, I do my own diet record and do my own nutrient analysis just to see, and I'm eating about 30-35% fat, you know, 15-20% protein, so I'm only eating like 50-60% carbohydrate.
Yeah.
That's what the paleo book for athletes, mm-hmm. that's their recommendations, which is crazy.
That is crazy. Yeah, which demonstrates a few things. First, that a vegan diet is not as protein devoid as most people think. And second, that paleo diet in perhaps its purest form, if there is one, I don't know. You know, we don't want to get into vegetarian versus vegan versus paleo here, but it's not in the way that it's, you know, meant to be. It's not eating bacon and hamburgers all the time, and it's not like focusing tons and tons on meat. It's really focused on the vegetables and whole foods, and some of that is meat, but as a result, you know, they're not getting 50% of their calories from protein. It's not that extreme a difference. So that's just another example of the diets, you know, ethically, of course, very, very different, and yeah, nutritionally, sure, they have some big differences, but they are based both on whole foods, and as you just said, their nutrient ratios can be almost identical in terms of macronutrients. So
right, and if you're really influenced by paleo and it's something that you want to do, you can do it and be vegan. Lots of people are doing it.
Sure. And there, I wrote a post about this, and it's tough because if you're going to be, you know, really strict about it and not eat beans and not eat grains, then it does certainly get very difficult. I don't know. I tend to have some serious problems with the arguments that you shouldn't eat beans or grains, but that really is for a different discussion here, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. So, Matt, we've gone about an hour now, so I think that is plenty. I mean, this has been good. I think this is exactly what I envisioned when thought about doing this. Just something that we could go deeper than the book does, a little bit more with personal examples and what we actually eat. Any other topics to hit on? I think we got on most that I had intended to talk about. Any more for you, Matt? Are we good?
No, I think we're good. I'm looking at your email here. I think we covered a lot of it. You know, I think you have a great readership, you know, and seeing the support for your site and the book has been great. It's kind of it's very exciting.
It is exciting.
You know, because just 5-6 years ago, it was like, oh, Robert Cheek and Brendan Brazier, you know, like they're the vegan athletes,
sure,
the two of them, you know. And I think now we're ushering in this whole new, like, plant-based, you know, vegan-ish athlete thing, and sure, it's great to see.
It is good to see, and I will write about this, I'm sure, on my blog, but one of the things that's been so cool about this tour is that every single event I've done so far, and it's been now, I think, 16 of them, or maybe more, there's somebody there who comes up and has lost, like, 30 or 60 pounds on, you know, on a plant-based diet, and in my site, you know, they may have found it at the beginning, or they may have found it, you know, halfway through their journey, but it's just amazing to see the changes that this, you know, that people are making as a result of this lifestyle. And, you know, so many people come up to me and say that after they went vegan, their asthma went away, or their back pain went away, or whatever else, their knee pain went away. And, like, I had heard all that stuff before, but I kind of always assumed that was like the 1 in 100 people who it happened to, and then they would, of course, be very vocal about it because they wanted to share it everywhere, so that was all you heard. But, like, you know, when I see, I don't know, 30 people at an event and 3 or 4 of them come up and tell me about, you know, some pain that just went away, it's just pretty neat. Like, it's of course, it's still not scientific. It's totally anecdotal, but it just feels like, I don't know, it's just very special that this sort of thing happens and that so many people notice so many benefits. So that's been really exciting for me. I did not expect that really to happen. And I don't know, it just makes me very happy to be doing this and be promoting a diet that seems to be so good.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, this kind of, like, historical perspective, right? I've been vegan since the mid-90s, which seems so long ago. And it used to be that you were giving up something to be vegan, and you, like, felt good about that because, you know, you were doing something better for the animals and the environment. And then now it's like, no, you're not giving up anything. You're actually gaining from eating this way. Right. And that's great. That's great.
Yeah, it's. I mean, of course, you're still gonna. It's gonna be a big change from your normal lifestyle. But if you do have access to, like, a Whole Foods, for example, just, you know, one store, it almost isn't making any sacrifices. I mean, you can get, you know, that Beyond Meat stuff that tastes and looks exactly like chicken and seems like chicken. I mean, you know, it's almost like it's not a big. Of course, it's always a big choice and big lifestyle decision to go vegan, because, you know, there are a lot of non-food, you know, things that come into play too, but it's like, it's almost like it's just a diet choice you can make now, like any other diet choice, and it's not like the extreme sacrifice choice anymore. It's just sort of like one of many, which is part of the reason that we're seeing so many people gravitate towards it,
right? You know, and I lived in Boyle Heights, which is a neighborhood in East LA, for a few years. And, you know, we went to the big Mexican grocery store down the street, and, you know, one huge array of produce, an unbelievable amount for cheap, and there's a tiny Mexican company that I don't even remember the name of that makes like a dehydrated, you know, vegetarian carne asada. And you buy this bag for like $1.50, and you go home and you hydrate it, and you saute it up with your vegetables, and now you have this, like, vegetarian carne asada from a grocery store in East LA, you know?
Yep.
Like, those possibilities exist. It's amazing.
Yeah, and of course, we're not saying that you should eat that food all the time, and one of the great things about not having quite as many choices is that you actually tend to, at least if you're doing it right, you tend to make many more whole food choices, like just because you can't stop at McDonald's anymore, for example. So of course, yeah, whole foods over processed, but it is really nice that you can get those sort of things, and like you can go get a carne asada burrito, like I will every time I go to San Diego. There's this one, Rancho's, I think it's called. So it's just great that you don't have to give that stuff up forever because there are those options. So anyway, enough great. About how great this diet is. Most people on here will probably already be more than on board. But hopefully everyone has found this helpful. And Matt, I appreciate your time in doing this, as well as all of your help with the book, of course. And I'm looking forward to hanging out.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. I can't wait to host you here in California. It's going to be a good time.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot. Take it easy, everybody. We will talk to you soon.